Welcome and thank you for coming to tonight's forum. My name is Deanne Lagerquist and I'm part of an almost ever-changing team of summer teaching staff coordinators, but right now together with Barb Rossing. And I'm here to moderate and facilitate this evening's conversation, this evening's forum on the topic, the quincentenary, what are your hopes for the next 500 years? Perhaps it's useful, since we're an ever-changing group of people here, to say something about a forum at Holden. What is its purpose and how is it conducted? As I understand it, and everyone who introduces these introduces them slightly differently, but as I understand it, a forum is really an exercise in sort of the consolation of the saints, that we are teaching one another. We're trying to deepen and clarify our understanding of some topic. Generally, these are not debates in which we expect at the end to take a vote, yes or no. Do you have hopes for the next 500 years, yes or no? That's not that we assume that there is hope. And we'd like to talk about what those hopes are. Because this is a conversation in a community of saints, we hope and ask that you listen carefully to those who speak, that you respect their experience and their opinions, and we would hope that everyone would feel free to speak out of their own experience and to express their own opinions. There are not right answers, although we do hope to move toward, as I said, a clearer and deeper understanding of what is true. We also stick quite rigidly to a one-hour session. That does not mean that we expect the conversation to finish in 1 hour, but only that this session will finish in 1 hour. I would hope that the conversation will continue as you leave this evening, over meals tomorrow, as you walk on the trails, as you run into people in the bathroom, you know, wherever it is the conversation happens. On the bus, the boat, you know, wherever it is that, and perhaps that even you'll take and the questions that you hear tonight and along with you when you go down the hill. Our format this evening will be that I'll make some introductory comments about our topic, and then we have two people who are here as guests, who have agreed to start us off. The figure I like to use for this is priming the pump. Not that either Carol Nolte or Mel Seagram have the answer. If they had the answer, there'd be no point in having a conversation, right? They're not the experts. They are equals among equals who come first chronologically, but not in expertise or authority. And so they'll simply be leading off. The theme at Holden this summer is a whole new world. This theme was chosen with several things in mind. One, very specifically, was the quincentenary, the 500th anniversary of Columbus's arrival in this hemisphere, with a concern that we look back at that, and that certainly we remember, and that we repent, as the ecumenical motto for this year has been, but also that we would renew, that we don't merely look back, but that as the term repent implies that we look back and then we turn around, that we don't simply go in the same direction, but that we find new direction. So that a whole new world is both backward looking at what has been, but also forward looking into the future. Those of you who've been going to Joe Everson's Bible study this week on Jeremiah have had something of this already, I think. He's been talking to us about home and the difference between home and exile, and also Jeremiah as a prophet of hope. We wanted to bring some of that into our forum tonight, so that the quincentenary is not only a time for grieving, for sorrow, for repentance, but also that it might be an opportunity for us to hope about what will happen in the next 500 years, and perhaps even to plan and to strategize, which we can do when we have hope, when we're not paralyzed. So, with that, we'll turn, we'll maybe go, Mel and Carol, let's keep going, and then the conversation into the larger circle.
Okay, I'd be happy to begin. Carol and I had a conversation before. We have not rehearsed. We have only very loosely tied together some thoughts about what we were going to express. And the idea, as Dan said, was that we were going to try to bring you into the conversation and talk about what signs of hope we see today. With Carol's permission, I'm going to ramble a little bit first and recast this in sort of a broader perspective. I happen to live next to Fermilab, and so I hear a lot about the Big Bang where I live. And what I would like to do is, instead of just looking at the last 500 years before we look at the next, think in terms of going back millions of years. And the scientists at that institution that's next to, or about a mile from my house, talk about a Big Bang. That at some point, and we can't talk about a point in time because before that, there was no time, there was no space, there was no substance. An event happened, and all these things came into being. Poetic people talk about what I think is the same event differently. James Weldon Johnson says, "And God spoke." And in our record that we read, there are creation stories. And God was at work, is what we believe, or what I believe, and created peoples. But the creation stories always start with people in one place, one people. But God was certainly present, and His Spirit and breath was on the waters. Let's step forward now to a time just a few thousand years before the Common Era, and the era like Joe has been talking about in the Bible studies. And the picture then is that these peoples are scattered, and they're multiplied, and they're fallen. But God is still at work on that place, but He's not pleased. But the people have developed a need for laws and property and things like that, and place that they claim. But that's still all part of that same story that began back when God spoke. And another point I think that we don't often probably talk about is that there were other stories that were also being written. There are also other records and other stories that people remember. But I feel that God was present in those as well. We are still all part of that first story. 2,000 years ago, another story was developed that we remember, and God's Spirit was present within that and came in a special way in that story. But again, that's all still part of that same big story. And in that era, there were other stories being written, and other people remember and revere other stories. But I think this is God's creation, and He was present and working in those stories as well. In some of the forums in some of the sessions this past week, and in our churches, we've been looking at the 500 years just past. And I think we would have to say that just as in that story we read about in Jeremiah, God could not be pleased with some of the things that have taken place. But His Spirit is present and at work in this world, and it's still part of that same story. What makes it really different, though, and difficult for me, is that the story that we are in today has some peculiarities about it. With our free choice, we have developed some weapons, some technology that really can radically change God's story. We can literally wipe humanity off the face of the earth. As health improves and things like that in certain parts of the world, and if we look at the world as a whole, population is growing at a rate that if we looked at it and extrapolated, we would run out of room, or as went on the nature hike, and we saw how deer overgraze this area. This earth will be overgrazed if we would just simply extrapolate. Now, when I was talking to Carol about this before, she said, wait a minute, this is supposed to be something hopeful. And I think it is, and I'm going to tell you some things I think that do make it hopeful. But that's where we are. We're at a different place. We're at a place in God's story where we are creating garbage at a rate that we have trouble finding places to put it. And we're changing this mantle around our globe at a rate that the astronauts who have been in space can see. And just think of what a little period of time that is. And so these things that I've just iterated are could be troubling, and they are troubling. And there are people who say that this is perhaps a Kairos time, a time of decision, that something drastic has to happen. And so we ask ourselves, is it that time, and is it a time of prophets? And unfortunately, just like Jeremiah's time, you don't know until after the fact who the real prophets are. But can we or dare we be hopeful? And I think we can. And I think the reason we can is the story is still that same story. And it's that story that Jeremiah was bringing. And I think that we could listen to what he says. And he's, in one sense, he said, bloom where you're planted. He said, be responsible citizens. Plant, build. Marry. If he'd been in our situation, I think he would have said vote, argue, make your presence part of the community that you're in. I think that his litmus test of saying how we look at the poor, the widows, the sojourners is still the litmus test. And I think that that's how we know. 500 years hence, will our church have made a difference? What's his name? Barry, the poet we've heard today. Wendell Berry. Some of his writings I've heard say no, the church has to die. But I think I go along with Jeremiah. I think it's wide open. I think everything is wide open. And, will Christians make a difference? How will they know? Will they know us by our love? I think it's wide open. I think it's up. We're being called, and it's up to us. As a layperson, sometimes I get discouraged by hearing our church, fret and worry about questions like apostolic succession. I think that there are other things that need more attention, but I think that that there are some signs of hope. What are these signs of hope? Well, one real sign of hope, I think, is I don't remember what the organization is, but there's an organization that has kept what they call the doomsday clock. And it was moving toward midnight, and if it got to midnight, that meant that that Holocaust had arrived, that we would have been firing these bombs and missiles that would destroy us. And I think that the way they had it, it was up to like 3 minutes before the hour, and now it's been set back, and I don't know what it is. If anyone knows, it can say. Quarter tail or something like that. But there has been significant improvement. We are less apt today, in their view, to blow each other up. Who do we thank for that? Well, is Gorbachev the Nebuchadnezzar that God has used to answer our prayers? Perhaps so, but I think there are signs of hope that in that area. In my experience, the areas where I see work being done amongst the poor and homeless often are organizations called PADS, people assembled, or whatever the next word is, to deliver shelter. By and large, these are churches, not necessarily Lutherans, but they are churches. And the neat thing about that is, as they deliver shelter, they are ministered to by the poor and converted and changed. And so I see that is hopeful. I see signs of hope. So I think that where I come out of this and the next 500 years, that I think that that we are simply called to be faithful, to pray and work for peace, and that we're to do it even if we find ourselves being the last Christian on earth. That's what we're asked to do. And I am hopeful. And,
okay. When Deanne and Barbara asked me to think about do this yesterday, I thought, oh, well, I'll think of something. I can't think of anything right now. I'll go to sleep on it and wake up with something. You know, do you work that process? And I went to sleep on it, and I woke up, and I was a blank this morning. Anyway, I try to organize a little bit, and I'm not a real good systematician, but I think that what I'd like to ask people to, so that we can have a conversation, is it seems to me it's helpful to think of what your hopes are for the future for like people, you know, what your hopes are for the international community or for our nation, or for your city, a local city, and maybe Holden or the church, and then maybe what your hopes are for structures, like political structures. I certainly have some hopes for economic structures, and maybe some of you are more economically savvy about what things have to happen, but I'm quite sure that there needs to be new economic structures, and I think that most people are beginning to be aware of that need. And then I think there are some other things that scientists need to tell us about, what kinds of discoveries they're looking for in medical things and things like that. But I thought it'd be, just from my own little microcosm, first to say something about I think you, Deanne, said something about, well, say something about the fact that you're from Los Angeles. And lots of people in the nation have all kinds of images of Los Angeles, but we have a new police chief, which I think already has made a difference in relating to the community. So I'm very hopeful about things that can take place in Los Angeles now with the people of color in that community, because there has been a real despair, and that's both an economic problem as well as a kind of racial tension that's created by a lot of different things between blacks who haven't made it in our system, and the economic repression that's going on, and the Korean community that's moved in on them. And so I think we're going to be learning something in the near future about how communities that differ in their values and in their cultural background, how we can talk together plan for some kind of peaceful future. And I think that Williams, who is a person of color himself, will be a vast improvement to Chief Gates, who has now finally retired. Also, just as I was leaving home, they were uncovering a whole network, almost like a secret CIA within the LA police, with all kinds of military, paramilitary techniques. And I think that that alone will scare all kinds of people into saying, is this what a police force should be? What about peace officers? So I think that, you know, there'll be some good things that come out of that that situation. And that's from my standpoint from my city. I thought it might be interesting. I also was thinking about, what about Holden? I don't know about 500 years, but maybe the next 50. I mean, I might say, well, 500 years. I really don't think I'm going to live that long, but I do hope to live for a while, and I hope that there, you know, short of the second coming, if there's still, if people are still here, that there's something going. One of the things, it always strikes me as interesting to hear what comes out of our board meetings, and I'm on the board, and this year somebody got to talking about, we've got to be, well, there was a mine engineer up, and they were talking about structures within the mine that were collapsing, and even if they didn't collapse now, even if the mine has had a couple of little collapsings and it's balanced out a little bit, that they're going to have to do something. So I got these wild ideas about what if that whole mountain caved in? I mean, somebody talked about that. What if that whole mountain caved in? And then I thought, we could have a lake right here. We didn't have to go all the way to Holden. So, I mean, I think that probably this forum should invite you to be as wildly imaginative. Also, today, I sort of say this because it's always fun to have these kinds of ideas surface. That Chuck Anderson and I he's also on the board. We kind of went around, we were talking about, well, what are we going to do when this building, what if this building should, if we need to replace it? I mean, are we going to just put it back the way it is, or are we going to do something different? So we were sort of wildly imagining what we could do if we had to replace a particular building, and would we put it back the same way, or would we build some different kind of structure? So I invite you to think about some really wild dreaming, both about your city or about home.
Great. Well, these are wonderful beginnings, and to both expanding our sense of the time frame, mm-hmm. you know, that we go back not just 500 years, but we go back to the beginnings. And that how we see our beginning is really important to how we see our future. Our beginnings give us the start of our vision, but also a shorter time frame because, you know, people ask me, where are you going to be in 5 years? And I'm like, oh, I don't know. I don't know where we're going to be tomorrow. You know, sometimes too big a time frame is also paralyzing. So bigger and smaller and an invitation to be really wild about it, I think, is helpful. Some indications of some of the problems that we might be facing about population and violence and garbage and poverty, but also some very specific things that can change. Carol just notes leadership. So with that, I throw it open to you to be wild or very concrete about what you hope for where you live, however you define that, small or big.
Just one thing I heard, a friend over here mentioned the Big Bang theory has been, I heard that's perfectly good, acceptable theology as long as you acknowledge the Big Banger.
Would others have signs of hope that they have experienced or seen in their communities or their churches that they would like to share? Anybody have stories to tell?
Good, maybe, Janelle.
I was just thinking on the environmental problems, there's a lot of gloom and doom stories around, but I really think if we get our act together that there's still time for extraordinary renewal. And one of the stories that I remember reading in Organic Gardening some time back, you probably have read this too, was they decided to redo an old farm that was absolutely, the soil was absolutely worn out. And they figured it would take them 10 years to do it. And they started trucking in, you know, manure and planting cover crops and pounding in and doing all these things. And it only took 3 years, actually, with this kind of intensive redoing of the soil. So I think if we all get busy, you know, we can.
Wait until you see what we're going to grow on top of those tailings when we start pumping the you-know-what up there.
I've been real encouraged with the stories coming out of Habitat for Humanity. It allows very ordinary people to do small things to make a big difference.
That is a neat story, and it goes all the way from Alaska to the southern tip of our country, and there are forms of habitat that are also being, and under their aegis, that are going on in Central America.
So, do you work in Habitat?
No, but I've been with some groups that volunteered to do that.
Does anybody here work for Habitat? Mm-hmm. Where have you done?
Build
houses.
Where? Tell
us. Durham, North Carolina.
Oh, great.
Yeah. And Polly didn't commit, the other couple that's with us is on the board of directors of the Habitat for Humanity there in Durham. They help decide who gets the houses, working with people, help them get financing and sweat equity worked in and things like that. One of the nice things about it is that people who are going to receive the house have to agree to work so many hours in somebody else's too. Uh-huh. But there's a lot of us who like to work on it like that. It doesn't take a great deal of skill to drive nails or pull electrical wires and so forth. And if you haven't tried it, you really ought to.
There's a lot of that going on in the Southeast.
Yeah, in the Southeast, I would brag a little bit that the Southeast probably is leading the country on Habitat for Humanity. Mainly because Jimmy Carter was there. That's right.
Our church in Greenville, South Carolina is involved in with a group in Greenville building houses too for Habitat, under Habitats.
And it's interesting, some of the stories, came home and told Blanche about, it was a week ago, Saturday I worked on it. There was a young fellow from Duke that was out working with us, and that poor young fellow, he tried for an hour to drive a nail. He had never driven a nail before in his life, but he was out trying to, and showed him a little bit, how to hold a hammer, do a little bit. Pretty soon it was working, but he had never driven a nail before in his life, and but yet he was willing to go out and try to do something. So maybe there's a little bit of hope with people like that around too.
Well, I'm a bit surprised nobody has, 500 years is sort of the time frame when Malthusian disaster is going to occur, if it does, and nobody seems to know what to do about it. Population of the world is what, 5.5 billion now, and within 100 years will become untenable unless something very dramatic happens. And it seems as if this drives many of the problems, the social problems, environmental problems, that's sort of the underlying causal determinant. And I don't have any easy answers to that, but it seems as though the next, this time frame we're talking about, and probably sooner than that, is the time which something, some very profound change in cultural or social ways of looking at this will have to occur. I mean, I don't see any indication in the world now that people talk about it a lot, but all the numbers are still progressing in this Malthusian curve. I don't know if anyone has any more optimistic way of looking at it than that, but that seems to be the critical underlying factor for humanity over the next couple hundred years.
We talked about that just briefly earlier, that if we talked about the future of Holden, if population growth continues at those kinds of rates, this would have to be a place that was inhabited. We have to inhabit every habitable place on Earth if that were allowed to continue. Of course, the Malthus theory says that you have, what is it, it's starvation or natural disaster are the things that have done it in the past, but these are not pleasant.
According to him, though, that would have already happened a good while ago.
Yeah. Those are temporizing arguments. Clearly, the growth is geometric. Whether the growth is 2.5% or 2.1% hardly makes a difference over time, still 500 years. It's a disaster in any case.
We've been able to forestall that with the Green Revolution, but that's been fueled by use of herbicides, pesticides, and fertilizers.
Somebody was about to talk back here, yeah.
Yeah, about the next 500 years, I have a difficult time trying to imagine that. I'm lucky if I can think of what I want to do in the next 5 months till Christmas. And that's pretty long-range planning for me. And I think maybe, I don't know, it just seems to me that that's a one way of approaching the problem is by increments. That if the next 5 months or the next 5 weeks or whatever, I begin to take on some focus and some order and some joy, and where spirituality and the practical things in life just become one with us, and God is not singled out for special events, but a constant pervasive power, then I think the future is going to take care of itself. I don't mean to be sanguine about that. I think long-range planning on the part of people who obviously need to in terms of the economic structures and transportation and disarmament and all those things. But for most of us, and then the incremental things that can be done, I think this place I don't think it's supposed to be a prototype for everything, every church, but it's an interesting challenge, a model here. How do you get such a diverse group working? I still haven't figured this out. I don't know if I will in the 2 weeks, but it's fascinating to me. And I'd like to hear from particularly the young staff people here that whether they feel a sense of belonging and being wanted and needed here more than they do at home in their home church. And why is that? And what things could we in our home parishes learn from this place? How could they take on a new shape of their own, indigenous, out of their own milieu? I think that's a fascinating thing, what not just what happens here, but what happens when we go away. And then I'm thinking also in terms of the coming election, and I'm always interested in politics, and particularly every 4 years that my hopes kind of revive and then dash, but I think at this point that I'm not so sanguine about, you know. I don't make the easy equation between the gospel and some kind of democratic politics at all. I think there's a lot of change needed. I think I have a bias that the outs now ought to be given a chance. If nothing else, they'll just come in and make their own mischief. But it will be another form of mischief, too. And I think even those of us who may feel that Clinton and Gore are going to offer some fresh hope, if they make it, as a Democrat, I'm not at all convinced we will, because we Democrats only have a firing squad, we form a circle. So I think we'll find a way of getting Bush elected, I'm sure.
Straight down at our feet.
Yeah, I'm sure we will. So, but supposing we goof it up and get in, then what happens? And I really don't think one can be very sanguine about this. Clinton is busy talking about, and we're not hawkish enough on the Gulf right now. So I would think that to put ourselves into any situation we have with another kind of slant to it than the prevailing politically correct acceptable wisdom.
Thanks, Bob. Sven?
Yeah, my name is Sven. I must say I don't see much hope for the future just in learning how to drive a nail. I think our hope is in the fact that we have a story. And the part of the story that I think we should concentrate on is the one that Jesus mentioned earlier in his ministry, that he was declaring the acceptable year of the Lord. And I believe he was referring to Jubilee and the Jubilee concept. And I think that concept has never really been worked out, and it's going to take more than the next 500 years to do that, but it would be a very good thing to work at. And if land ownership gets down to basics and gets evened up for everybody every 50 years, what would the Yugoslavs have to fight for? And I think we have the story, and we need to look at that story, and here at Holden, we look at the story a lot. The story that we have, the Jews and the Christians, that's the way it goes.
Thank you.
Come on.
Yeah, Don and then Cindy.
I have a lot of hope, and it comes from several sources. I'll name just one, because the gentleman up above remarking on how we talk a lot about the world situation, he sounded a little bit discouraged about that. We talk a lot but don't do much. Well, he's quite right. That's quite true. But I find in the talk itself great hope. And the reason I do is as a biologist, comparing ourselves to other organisms in nature, we are by no means the only ones that destroy our environment. Not at all. There are, I could name several hundred species that overpopulate, pollute, not just mammals. It goes right down into the insect world. Prairie dogs, I like to use an example on some of my walks. They pollute their own villages so badly that every 5 to 10 years the whole village has to move. Many times insects have enormous blooms, eat everything in sight, eat themselves into starvation. The lemmings go through socio-biological behavioral changes that cause them to not commit mass suicide, that's all mythology, but to mass migrate. And anytime you have a mass migration, you're going to have massive mortality. Okay, you see, those organisms cannot talk about it. They cannot begin conversation on their problem. And so they have to take what naturally comes, what is in terms of the system. They have no choice. We do. And we are talking about it. And we're beginning to talk about it on a worldwide scale. Now, things are going to get worse before they get better. I mean, they are, and I don't want to sound depressing, but you know, there's going to be enormous starvation. Their population is going to still keep on increasing for quite a while. There's going to be numerous kinds of diseases. I don't mean to sound like a prophet here either. Those things are going to happen, but there's going to be more and more and more talk, and there's going to be a rising, there is a rising consciousness about all this, and not just at unique places like Holden. I mean, I hear it in redneck country where I live, and I'm impressed. And so because of that, I have great hope.
One of the things I forgot to mention, I think it was a sign of hope, was this recent conference in Brazil, which is a worldwide raising of consciousness about the environment. I wasn't particularly proud of the way we participated in it, but it, it's a sign that we are beginning to grasp some of the, as a globe, some of the concerns. There's several back here now.
Cindy, and then we'll move up into this cluster here. Yeah.
Lynn was sort of talking as Ben was talking, but I, when I look at what I see, I have no hope. And when I look at concrete reality, and maybe it's, I don't know if it's because of where I live, but when I look at what's happening to, for instance, you know, black men between the ages of 15 and 25 don't have much chance of surviving in the inner city. When I see the excruciating agony of poverty that is so pervasive, and when I see the enormous willingness of us to continue having at the expense of others, and in so many ways and so many places, and the just the enormous, overwhelming, addicted society that we have to continue having at the expense of others, I really find no hope. And then I think about, and then I think about the gospel story, and it's only in spiritual reality that I can see hope for us to make a better world. And then to have the story of the gospel of Jesus calling us to radical change, I mean, to radical relinquishment, and to discipleship that means, I think, really moving over to be with and to be on the side of marginalized peoples. And again, I almost find no hope in that, except that I believe that Christ only calls us where we can follow. So somehow I believe we're being called to radical change, and we're being called to something which we can do. And I find tremendous hope there. And I don't think that's just in the Christian faith. It's only that it's in the Christian faith that I know it. And then I notice the within certain parts of our society, of which probably most of us are a part, the interesting kind of convergence of the outer journey of discipleship in this world and inner journeys, and the increasing awareness of, you know, going deeper into one's relationship with God within and the spirit within, and deeper psychological understanding of the demons that bind us and the things that limit us and the darknesses within, and the way people are probing the inner life and using that probing to become better followers of Christ in the outer life. And in that, I mean, in the story and the call of Christ, I find hope, and in, it seems to me, the deepening ways that people are learning to follow that call, I find hope. And I was remembering this, I think I might have told this to a little group earlier this week, but I was remembering this friend of mine in Seattle, who's a tremendous activist and knows as much ugliness in the world as I've ever known, I'm sure. He's a Lutheran pastor, and you know, as they're fighting the nuclear turret submarines all the time and blah, blah, blah. But he's always laughing also. And I had always wondered about that, because I get so serious and heavy. And he has this bubbling laugh that just rolls over. And I once asked him why he was able to laugh so much when he was facing so many ugly realities. And he simply laughed and he said he knew the end of the story. And it's kind of like what you said, Sven, but I've always held on to that, what he said about knowing the end of the story, because I think that is, I mean, to me, that is the source of hope.
Martha? Well, I have a hard time with 500 years, too. I look at the issue of people of color, that's the term now, and we talk about inclusive language, but because we keep labeling people of color, blacks, whites, that binds us into a predicament of which we can't grow from. And I thought, in my almost 50 years of life, on my birth certificate it says that I am colored, and my parents really struggled so that we could be called Negro. And at 25, I decided I wanted to be black. And now at 49, I decided I want to be called African American. And yet there's still the title of being a person of color. And we've gone through the same thing with Mexicans, Chicanos, Native Americans, Indians. And we always have these titles. I hope, my hope is that we can lose titles and that we will all be people, because that's the basis for what we have to start in order to begin to build a strong society.
Well, thank you.
Well, I just want to come, come to the defense of 500 years a little bit here.
You're not
well, can I help pick up the question too? Well, and let's actually take a poll. How many want to be alive in 500 years? Okay, yeah. So we're not planning on being Methuselah or anything, but I guess what it means for me is that I really like observing anniversaries and thinking of them as moments to sort of take stock of my life and of the nation and the world and whatever. So I observe, well, like Hiroshima Day tomorrow, I think it's really important to remember this is the anniversary of the dropping of this bomb. Or Kristallnacht, you know, when the shops of Jewish people were destroyed in Germany. And anniversaries that remind us of our past, not just to wallow in the past, but also to take stock and look ahead. And that's why I guess thinking about this Columbus one was really important to me in the year that's gone by. Now, interestingly, it seems like, and perhaps we in the progressive community or whatever can claim this as a victory, it's kind of, the Columbus anniversary has kind of fizzled out in the political or secular realm or whatever. I think part of it was that one guy that stole a lot of the money that was set aside for the government. No, it was a terrible incident of corruption in the Bush administration, and they don't have enough money to be able to celebrate, but still there was that series on PBS and stuff, and I watched that, you know, Columbus Age of Discovery on PBS. I pledged to get my little mug now, and I like drinking my coffee out of my Columbus mug and thinking about this anniversary in the same sense. I think that the bicentennial in 1976 was a really important time to try to take stock of our country and reorient ourselves. And I guess that's why I'm intrigued with this 500. Now, you know, sort of what, there are obviously a tremendous number of things we need to repent from, but then what is the direction we want to turn ourselves to also for the next 500 years? And I've got a new image now from Joe Jordan, just sort of in defense of the long view here. This is this guy who was this wild and crazy sort of astrophysicist. I don't even know what he was up here a couple weeks ago, who finally explained to me why he thinks this, what I thought was a wacko project of trying to spend all this money to find out when the next meteorite is going to hit the Earth before it hits us, far enough out. So that, and I said, well, what's the purpose? Just so we know when the planet's going to be blown up by the next giant bang or whatever. And he says, no, if we find out far enough in advance, the idea is they're really going to send up little rockets to deflect it. Well, and he believes in this. And he works for NASA.
It may be his job to believe
so
in it.
I'm kind of fooling around with that as an image for the church, possibly, that our job as prophets in the world can maybe be on the basis of the stories you say, Sven or Cindy, that we know the outcome would be to zing little zingers. We don't have, and Joe was saying you don't have to have very powerful rockets either. If you do it for far enough ahead in advance, you can deflect it. Okay, if the church could be that kind of vision for the world of somehow trying to just deflect, you know, obviously we don't have a lot of power as people of God, nor should we seek it. But with our little zingers, our little jubilee ways in the world and in communities and stuff, if we can somehow turn ourselves now on this anniversary. 500 years is way too far out for any of us personally be planning for, but we can envision what we want to see for our our children and grandchildren and their, and be trying to zing little rockets that direction to turn ourselves, our life, our culture. And then an anniversary is a good time to take stock and try to do some of that.
I like that analogy because it's like a ship, you know, it takes a long time to turn it, but you just turn it a little bit, but if you keep that going forever, it does turn. And that's what you're talking about, that it's 500 years is a long time, but if we just make a little course change now over 500 years, that makes a big difference.
I'm starting to hear some interesting things emerge here about both, and to go back to the Habitat for Humanity in a way, what you said about it may encapsulate is that on the one hand you said people put sweat equity and they do something for themselves, but also they're pledged to share, and that it's making a home, right? And that's partly what we're talking about here. What is it to be at home? Columbus thought he was going to go out and get something for the folks back home, right? Take all this home with him to his own home. He forgot that some other people already had a home. It's a wonderful incident I heard from a man I serve on a committee with, a Native American who works in a school and as a custodian, and he was asked to come and talk to some of the children about his heritage, who came to be Columbus Day. The teacher said, please, Mr. Russell, come into the room. I want you to see what the children have done. And they made the big bulletin board like most of us probably did, you know, with the three ships and all of this. But what was so amazing was the caption, which said, 500 years ago, Columbus arrived in Mr. Russell's native land. That there had been a change of view for those kids about who was at home and who was being coming into someone else's home. We all need to be at home, right? That's part of it. But Sven is also challenging us to think about what it means to have a home and possessing or not possessing. So there are some things that are beginning to emerge here. And also Barbara, by saying, yeah, 500 years is a long time, but 500 years is a long time for us to think about, for our life. Margaret says, well, you know, in 50 years, I've been all these different things. Knowing what to call yourself is, in a sense, to be home, right? But what about the next people and the ones after that? 500 years is a long time, but we won't be there. Someone will be there. What do we want for them? Joe?
I just want to say a couple of things about our calling, it seems to me, as people of faith, is rather clear from the biblical mandate, and the church has always likened itself primarily to salt or to yeast. We're not going to be the dominant majority in this culture. The church never was, and this is not a Christian nation in that sense. Like those people in the Roman Empire, we see our calling to be faithfulness to Christ, whether it goes well or not. I'm reminded that the most powerful words of hope in the scriptures, in the Hebrew scriptures, are written from the Babylonian captivity era, a situation far worse than what we're in now, at least physically for us. And it's in situations of real exile and discouragement politically and socially that we have the strongest words of hope to people of faith. Second Isaiah and Jeremiah and indeed the Deuteronomic writings probably come out of that Babylonian captivity era when people didn't even have a homeland. I don't think about 500 years, but I think about the 21st century. And I ask, what are my hopes for the next 100 years? When you look at the 20th century, boy, what kind of a track record it's going to be with the two world wars and Korea and Vietnam and the problems of the ecology, of the ecosystem. I guess I'm a hopeful person by birth. I can be as negative about things as you, Cindy, and what you've said. I can be very fearful. But at the same time, I have a hard time envisioning that the 21st century is going to be worse than the 20th. And especially in terms of war, my deepest hope is that the United States is going to grow and mature. Maybe it's because I've lived in Europe enough. I think Europe and Scandinavia is far more civilized than the United States. And my hope is that the U.S. is going to be a more civilized and mature country, that we're going to begin looking at Canada and Scandinavia and Europe for healthcare systems that work, for a mediating position between capitalism and socialism, to recognize that greed is present in every system and that socialism can lend itself to bureaucracy. I think that we're going to remember this century. Gorbachev, to my mind, is going to be likened to Cyrus of Persia. I mean, especially now when he's suffering, out of power, out of favor. That's real. He's an amazing figure, I think, for what he's going to be remembered for, because he stood for liberty. And I guess I think that the vision of America is still strong enough that the last words of the Declaration of Independence are, of our Pledge of Allegiance, are with liberty and justice for all. And for 12 or 15 years now, we've been on such a liberty kick that I think, whether it be Bush reelected or Clinton, that the American people are going to start seeing the hollowness of all this freedom talk, and that this is a country that has to stand for both liberty and justice. So my deepest hope, and you can trace it historically, especially Lutherans, we have been very slow getting into American politics. And I think Christians, and especially Lutherans, have to think about the importance of political activity to influence what is happening through the governmental structures of our country. That I think.
Dan?
This dovetails on several of the ones there, particularly some of the things Margaret and Barbara said. But in listening to things that Maria and Cindy have been talking about in the quincentenary, it's been very important for me to look back in 500 years of where the church was involved in thinking through its faith theologically in ways that, at the very least, are terribly embarrassing to us now. We look back and say, how could the church, for example, have spent 100 years debating whether the indigenous people had souls? And yet for 100 years, that was the raging theological debate. Or how could the church have used the Bible to justify almost 300 years of human slavery of the African and indigenous people's slaves? But the question I do is, I say, now what are we doing today that 100 years from now people are going to go back and say, how could they have done that? And I have two areas in particular. There are many areas, but I have two areas that I hope 100 years from now it will have changed so much that people will look back and say, how could they have even debated that? One is, I think, the whole barrier between human beings and the rest of the natural creation. I think we have such a rigid dichotomy between what human beings are allowed and the rest of creation. I hope that will break down and we'll move towards more kinship with the rest of creation. And my other hope is that lesbian, gay, and bisexual people that will be fully recognized as full human beings, and we'll look back and say, how could that have even been questioned the way it is? And I hope people will look back and say, the same way we look at the way that people use the Bible to justify slavery, we'll look back and say, how could they use the Bible to oppress gay and lesbian people the way they did? So those are two of my hopes of using looking back in order to look forward.
Good, thank you. Did you want to speak? No, I thought I saw you. Okay.
Others? Barbara said something about that as Christians we don't have power, or as church people we don't have much power. But isn't that our strength? I look at, who are they going to remember, Mother Teresa or George Bush? Who's going to be remembered the longest? Mother Teresa has no power, no economic base, nothing but her love. Mm-hmm.
I'd like to not only give people a warning 5 minutes before we're going to start, but also when we're getting near the end, because I know there are people who hang back till the end before they want to say something, and we're moving toward the end. Maria has agreed to draw things together for us at the end by reading us a brief story of hope. But if there are others who would like to have nearly a last word, this is the chance.
Actually, I think I'll jump on that. One of the things I've heard a couple times tonight is how hard it is to envision 500 years hence. And I know for myself that that's very difficult, being as young as I am, to just think within this last century or within 5 months, 5 weeks, I'm going to be across the country doing a whole new thing. And so this 500 years is really hard, but I think it's really important. And I just think another way of looking at that, coming from a Native heritage in Americas and the Northeast of the Iroquois nations, of thinking about seven generations hence and what our actions now are going to be doing then. And with our lifespans now, that's 500 years is very easily seven generations hence. And I think that's very important to consider.
Others?
I think there's kind of a hope against hope, as I said. Maybe it's that we do have a pretty good idea of things that don't work well, and we could all enumerate those, but certainly the church, as we've known it, is forced at this point to make radical changes if it's going to even be around for 50 years in any kind of form. And I think that's a hope, and in politics as usual. We know that it's not going to work, whether it's Democratic or Republican. And it seems to me then the challenge is whoever gets in isn't as well, it's important maybe, but it's more important what we're doing here and what we do when we go home and what we do in just the place we are and the power of one.
Thank you, Scott.
Yeah, I was just going to say I sometimes have wondered if we would make it to the 21st century, but I have some hope now in the if we believe strong enough in that the way we think about things can ultimately make a tremendous difference. I think that is gaining ground. Maynard Fuller's thing, with Habitat for Humanity is an idea. It's a different idea about economics, how economics should work. And of course, that gets down to getting volunteers to pound nails and saw boards, but it was his vision that we could do our economics differently that drives, he calls it God's economics. If you've ever heard him speak, he is very convincing and has convinced people, across the country and all over the world that we could, we really can do things differently than we've been doing them. I think that's, it's a wonderful example, not just in the good-heartedness of people, but that dream of being able to do it, to do it differently. I think there is a new level of consciousness about, America is maturing slowly. We could have matured a lot faster if our political leadership had been willing to own up to our own evil, but they've wanted to protect us themselves from that. But that's gradually, the word is getting out, like everyone else in the world and in the globe. We have been as destructive as any, if many, if not more than most. So we're beginning to mature, and only as we mature, get that idea in our heads that we're not some isolated, perfect nation. Then the conversation can ensue. I think finally we're getting it in our heads that we have to be connected, and that we are connected, that we can no longer live in isolation, either from nature or from other peoples of the world. That idea is finally beginning to take hold. So some of those ideas give me hope. They haven't realized their potential yet, but there are some ideas out there that I think can shape at least the next years.
Thank you. Maybe I will turn to you for a minute.
I'm going to read you a story from the sacred book of the Mayan people. The Mayan people had the most advanced culture in this part of the Americas, and its center was in Guatemala and Mexico. The name of the story is The Prophet. Here it came to pass, more than four centuries ago, lying on his mat, on his back, the priest Jaguar of Yucatan heard the message of the gods. They spoke to him through the roof, squatting on his house, in a language no one understood anymore. Chilam Balam, he who was the mouth of the gods, remembered what had not yet happened and announced what would be. Stick and stone will rise up for the struggle. Dogs will bite their masters. Those with borrowed thrones must throw up what they swallowed. Very sweet, very tasty was that, what they swallowed, but they will vomit it up. The usurpers will depart to the limits of the waters. Then there will be no more devourers of man. When greed comes to an end, the face of the world will be set free. Its hands will be set free. Its feet will be set free.
Thank you. Really interesting parallels with the Jubilee that Sven pointed us to. Perhaps a fertile convergence for us to end on, the way that the scriptures that came with those who thought they were discovering something new and those who met them both call for a kind of setting free that includes justice. So thank you all for your contributions, quiet and spoken.